popular demand and a number of emails saying, why don't you let that song play through so we can hear what else they are saying? That was Mike and the Mechanics from way back. A little song called Silent Running. Good afternoon and welcome, my friends. Oh, here we go. All the little gremlins are out again, and it's only Tuesday. We'll be back straight after this. Special guest today, Eustace Mullins. Welcome back, my friends. It is Tuesday, and on this Tuesday, March the 8th, before I introduce my guest for this hour, Eustace Mullins, quick check of what's happening in the financial markets. Dow Jones Industrials are up a point at 10,938, NASDAQ off 9. The U.S. dollar is taking a hit today. Crude oil up 71 cents at $54.60 a barrel. Soon to show up at gas pumps near you. Needless to say, it caused a big rally in the metals. Gold up $5.60. Well, actually closed up $5.60 today at $440.50. Silver up 14 cents at $7.51. And platinum up 800. Check that, up $7 at $883. Some people out there almost had a heart attack. Palladium flat on the day at $223. Currently in Asian trading, gold's up 20 cents at $440.90, silver up a penny at $752, platinum up $2 at $885. The most definitive book ever written about the Federal Reserve was called The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, The London Connection, by my guest, Eustace Mullins. Good afternoon, sir. Welcome back.
Oh, good afternoon. Good to hear from you.
Oh, absolutely. Last time you were on the show, we kind of delved into the motivational force that you had in your youth investigating the Federal Reserve. And so we started at the beginning, and then we worked our way up to today. Today I want to start at the way we are today and work our way back, if that's possible. And I want to just briefly touch on a subject that you've also written about, which was called, I believe it was Death by Injection.
Oh, yeah, Murder by Injection.
Have you been following this Asian flu story by any chance?
Oh, they have these scare stories going all the time. You know, they said that we were going to have a flu epidemic like 1918. They've been saying that for the past year.
Right.
And then they also said recently in USA Today that the flu shots didn't make any difference.
What is your take on the stories? Because the stories that I'm getting on my side of the thing is that this virus has mutated from animal to human. Now it's going from human to human, which is the reason they bring up the 1918 epidemic as an example of what happens on human to human.
Well, the principal thing about the 1918 flu epidemic, as I point out in my book, Murder by Injection, was the large scale of use of vaccines prior to that epidemic. It's the first epidemic in history in which most of the victims were young, healthy men, which is very unusual. And the reason was that they were draftees on both sides of the war, German and the Allies, who were heavily injected with vaccinations of various kinds. And so these young men started dying like flies.
And is it your synopsis that that was in large part the reason for that epidemic in 1918?
Well, I quote authorities to that effect in my book, Murder by Injection. I had never thought of it myself. I had no idea that there was such a connection. But some investigators looked into it, and they found that the only reason for the epidemic of 1918 was the vaccination programs, which Germany indulged in as much as the Allies. And that's about the same amount of casualties.
Sure. Now, if you remember a couple of months ago, it seems longer, but it was only a couple of months ago, when there was a panic in the United States, when they announced that they had or they were running severely short of flu vaccines, you had people lining up for blocks.
Oh, yes. This is the sort of mass hysteria that they love.
Now, don't you think, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, don't you think that with the panic that's going to ensue, because we've had all the major health organizations, from the World Health Organization to various UN committees and health institutions within the United Nations, they are all talking about this pandemic that is coming with the Asian flu. Don't you think that it is possible that they could once again create a hysteria, if you will, about this bird flu? Because they say that this Asian flu virus kills 70% of the people that get affected by it.
Oh, yes, it was a terrible casualty. And also they say every year that the flu shot vaccine does not work on this year's flu. We have a different flu each year. And they say that they absolutely help us to control it. Well, if it's different each year, perhaps somebody's manufacturing it.
So would you put forward the argument that maybe this Asian flu virus is something that they are attempting to instill a panic, and obviously by that would be forcing people to willingly accept vaccines to prevent them from catching the Asian flu virus?
Oh, well, they'll accept any vaccine. But you remember the fictional swine flu epidemic of which brought Gerald Ford, defeated him for re-election, and brought Jimmy Carter into the White House. Jimmy Carter was from Georgia, where the Center for Disease Control was located, and apparently the CDC got behind this swine flu story, and that's the way they got Ford defeated.
You know, I don't know if you find this as interesting as I do, but all these things, whether you're talking about a virus or a vaccine, or whether you're talking about the Federal Reserve or the moneyed interests, they are all interconnected somewhere down the line.
Well, they're all sort of the Hollywoodization of everything, so that everything becomes part of a movie script for mass entertainment.
The mass entertainment right now is the Michael Jackson trial.
Well, it certainly is. It's perfect.
Yeah.
No. And the whole thing is so ridiculous. The fact that you have a black actor who doesn't like being black, and so he tried to make himself white and went through all sorts of operations and skin treatments and so forth, but he only pursued little white boys. He never pursued little colored boys.
Yeah, well, that's another reason I've left that story alone. It's just
it's a very touchy story.
It's just that the media is so enamored by it, and everything else takes a back seat to it. It seems.
Well, he was a child prodigy, and I've been infatuated with him ever since.
Oh, no question about that. Now on to the more interesting stuff, of which your expertise is always appreciated. Today, for instance, we've had a number of reports that have come out that indicate that a number of holders of U.S. dollars, namely China and India, are dumping their dollars because of obviously the deteriorating rate of the U.S. dollar.
Well, I would think that dumping this so-called debt would drive the price down, and they lose heavily by that. But perhaps it's time to get out or else.
Well, you also had earlier this week Warren Buffett announcing some $21 billion of his investment portfolio is now short the dollar, or in other words, he's divested out of the dollar and he's invested in euros and other foreign currencies.
Well, I think that's why Berkshire Corporation recently reported a 40% profit, because he's shorting the dollar, and Bill Gates is shorting the dollar also.
Do you think it's possible that not only the work that you have done for so many decades on trying to inform people about the Federal Reserve and the fiat currency, that in fact what you're starting to see now is a lot of people paying attention to what you said about a fiat currency, which is pretty much now in its declining years as the world's reserve currency?
Oh, yes, there's no question about it. You see, this book was published in 1953, and it's been circulating for 5 years, I mean 50 years, and a lot of people have read it and noted its contents during those 50 years, and it's beginning to have an effect. It's sort of like the Colorado River churning out the Grand Canyon. It takes a long time, but it eventually gets there.
Now, one of the things that you pointed out, obviously, with the Bretton Woods system and the macerations that took place after the Bretton Woods, when foreigners could still demand gold in lieu of U.S. dollars.
Yes, that was the basis of the currency, the specie, being interchangeable with it. And they gradually got rid of the specie entirely, and now it's just paper money with paper, backed by paper bonds, which means it has no value whatsoever.
Now, have you been following the stories, and I have another guest on during the week. His name's Al Martin, who has put forward the proposition that Russia is now forming alliances with non-OPEC countries, and OPEC countries themselves are looking at how to divest out of the dollar in pricing their oil. We'll have that question for Eustace Mullins when we return. Eustace Mullins, who wrote the definitive book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, The London Connection. Before we went to the break, I asked you whether or not you see some severe ramifications with the move that's going on, for instance, with the Gulf Cooperation Council and various other entities who trade their oil for dollars are looking at moving out of the dollar connection to oil and are seeking out either the gold dinar or possibly pricing oil in euros.
Well, it's not only the fact that new commercial alliances are being formed with these changes, but there are also new military alliances. For instance, China and Russia are seeking new commercial enterprises and also new military alliances. They're supposedly in an alliance right now which will supersede the world authority of the United States.
So with the world awash in dollars, Are we being too paranoid to say that the day of dollar supremacy is coming to an end?
Well, you know, with China and Russia in this pact, it's quite possible that the supremacy of the dollar will fade into insignificance with these new military alliances that have the dollar losing its supremacy as the world reserve currency.
But then what about the moneyed interests, such as the Rothschilds and these various other entities and the Rockefellers? I mean, if we are speculating about this, their being is threatened by, obviously, a collapse of the U.S. dollar.
Well, their wealth is threatened by the collapse, yes. But you see, they have a long-term program, and they don't work on a weekend program. They work 5-10 years in advance. So they have seen this coming for some time, and I would think they are well prepared for it.
So what do you think their plan is? Obviously, if they are seeing that they are major players on the world stage now, who are not taking the dollar in lieu of payments, and seem to be celebrating the demise of the dollar.
Oh yes, they certainly are. And if they're celebrating it, they undoubtedly know something, which causes them to celebrate. They feel that they have something to celebrate. For instance, the Chinese-Russia pact to hold down the United States, it's been predicted that on June the 20th, 2011, the China and Russia will form a protectorate of the United States because the United States can no longer maintain its borders and its economy is in deep trouble. So they feel like they can move in and protect us from ourselves.
So what do you see in the crystal ball for the future of America?
Well, I thought for some time that America reached its zenith in the 1920s. And it certainly went into a decline with the 1930s and Franklin D. Roosevelt and then Aaron being involved in World War II, which my mentor, Ezra Pound, fought against, and which Charles Lindbergh fought against, because they both realized that the United States could not make the mistake of intervening in a world war in Europe a second time. We got away with it the first time, but we couldn't repeat that performance and get away with it. And sure enough, it was a disaster for this country. We have been in a steady decline ever since 1945 because of the World War II.
The president was out today together with numerous other government officials, once again touting the success of their policy in the Middle East by pointing to the fact that you got demonstrations today in Syria and Lebanon. They say that freedom is on the march, even though I guess the largest demonstration was by Hezbollah, who want the United States out of the Middle East. Does this neoconservative philosophy that they have latched on, is it? Are we wrong to say that that policy is a failure, or is it a success, as they are touting it today?
Well, it's neither a success or a failure. It's simply a catastrophe. The neocon policy is now generally called the Straussian conspiracy after Professor Leo Strauss, because a number of his disciples are behind it. And so the Straussian conspiracy had some short-term gains, but now it's totally evaporating. You know, the last successful person in the Middle East was Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes.
And nobody has won since then.
Yes, well, that's unfortunately one of those events in history that everybody has forgotten about.
Well, yeah. Lawrence of Arabia himself was cast aside and had no further influence whatsoever.
You know, when you go back to that time, it amazes me that this administration is pretty much just following in the footsteps of early British imperialism. Because didn't Britain try to do the same thing in the Middle East?
Oh, yes. In fact, the British were the greatest tourists in the Middle East. They were there. They were fascinated by the whole area. And that's why Lawrence Arabia, again.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back, my friends. We are speaking with Eustace Mullins. And just before we got launched there on the last side of the break, I was asking Eustace about, haven't we learned, well, obviously the British attempted to change or bring democracy, if you will, to the Middle East in the 1920s, and they failed on that one. Obviously, their motivation at the time wasn't oil. Their motivation was just to spread Imperial Britain. Mr. Mullins, you there?
Yes. Well, I've just received a very large volume about the history of the Pilgrim Society, and the Pilgrim Society was a group of early Americans and British who have pretty much run the United States ever since. The Mellons and the Vanderbilts and all these people turn out to be Pilgrims. And in fact, there's been a recent book called The British Albion Seed, which claims that the American Revolution was entirely led by no more than 130,000 people. They were Pilgrims, Puritans, and Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. And that this was the backbone of the Revolution, spark-plugged the entire revolt against Britain. So, of course, with the Pilgrim Society in place, it was just a temporary revolt because they moved right back into power as soon as the Revolution was over.
Jumping forward to today, then, looking at U.S. foreign policy with its a policy on the Middle East, Britain, as we said in the 20s, obviously wanted to establish British imperialism. America's foreign policy today in the Middle East seems to be, and maybe this is a connection, maybe the powers that be within the secret societies understand or understood the danger of a Russian-China alliance of non-OPEC countries getting together and severing their ties between the dollar and commodities, in this instance being oil. So is it possible that this whole Mideast adventure has been planned in order to subvert this conversion of commodities into dollars?
Oh, there's no question about it, because Russia historically has been the traditional ally of the United States. You know, in our Civil War, when President Lincoln was in very dire straits, the Tsar sent the Russian Navy over here to help the United States preserve itself as a union. And so because of this, there's been a close relationship all along. In fact, Averell Harriman, who was a member of the Pilgrim Society, actually was dictator of Russia from 1942 to 1944 because Stalin had a nervous breakdown. And Averell Harriman moved in and functioned as a dictator of Russia for 2 years during World War II, which is not very widely known, but it's he ostensibly was U.S. ambassador to Russia, but he actually was a dictator of Russia during that period.
You know, when you bring up those points, then it also makes abundantly clear why the powers that be at the time were so afraid of McCarthy.
Oh yes, indeed, McCarthy really shook the foundations of this entire thing, and that's why McCarthy is reviled today as an evil monster, because he put such a fright into them. And you know, he was finally reprimanded by the entire Congress of the United States for having criticized Democrats. This was the heinous offense for which he was convicted.
Now, I'm going to throw you a curveball on this one. Do you see any connection between the attack on McCarthy and what we've recently witnessed with Ernst Zundel?
Oh, yes. That's very much the same process and very much the same people. You see, the attack on McCarthy, Eisenhower had Henry Cabot Lodge and Richard Nixon lead the revolt against McCarthy. And Henry Cabot Lodge, of course, was one of the New England pro-English outfits that have always worked with the Pilgrim Society and groups like that with the British Empire. So the attack on McCarthy was very much a British Empire operation, although he never knew it himself, of course.
Well, no question about it. It's just all these events that are unfolding right before our very eyes is, as I said, something that you've written about many, many years ago. And it's just a matter of trying to connect the dots. Do you spend time reflecting on what you've done and look at today's world and get a little bit of satisfaction in yourself knowing that you were right and they were wrong?
Well, I have no time to reflect, and I have no time for satisfaction. I'm still working 7 days a week. And my 82nd birthday is tomorrow. And it looks like another 15 years, at least, before I can afford to take a vacation.
So what are you working on as we speak?
I'm working on my autobiography, which will be very useful to a lot of people and explain why all these things happen. You know, I'm talking to you right now two blocks from the birthplace of Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson, the 20th century could almost be called the Woodrow Wilson century because he was such an admirable figurehead for all of the big operators in the 20th century, the British Empire and John D. Rockefeller and the Rothschild and everybody. He was a man who could work for anybody. He was a very adaptable person.
Yeah, well, and unfortunately, patriotism and loyalty to one's country has obviously long been subverted by the pursuit of wealth and power.
Yeah, well, he didn't really achieve either one because he wound up a broken man. But he did everything he was told to do and everything he was paid to do. And he did a good job for his employers, but he never really did much for himself because he wound up as a disaster. But he had a protege named Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who became president, and he promptly got himself three personal assistants, Alger Hiss and Harry Dexter White and Lockwood Curry, who carried on the good fight. And this is what Joe McCarthy found out. He found out that the world headquarters of communism was not Moscow, but Washington. And when he found this out and began to expose them, that's when the roof fell in on him.
Taking a book out of McCarthy's many stories, do you still think the U.S. State Department has largely been infiltrated and still is being infiltrated by communists?
Oh, not at all. The communists are passé now. In fact, I doubt there are very few communists in Washington. No, this was he was doing this in 1952. When it was a real problem, but the communists have been losing power in Washington ever since. In fact, the Straussian conspiracy, the neocons have completely replaced the communists, and in fact, the last half of the 20th century was devoted not to world war. We had two world wars in the first 50 years, and then the last 50 years were dedicated to the struggle between Trotskyite communists and Stalinist communists, and the Trotskyite communists, the neoconservatives won out, and the Stalin communists are history now.
Do you think these same people engineered what most people, if you speak to most people today and you tell them about communism, they will immediately shoot back at you, well, communism died when the Berlin Wall fell down.
Well, that's a very nice thing to say, but it's totally meaningless because it doesn't signify anything.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. You know, I mentioned the vilification of Joe McCarthy, and now we've just watched the events with Ernst Zindel. Gone are the days where people used to say, I may disagree with what you have to say, but I will die to defend your right to say it.
Well, I know them both quite well, Ernst Zindel and Joe McCarthy both, and they simply were human sacrifices to the juggernaut of modern politics.
Now, I think you've been, a little bashful here because from what I have read about you, you have come to be criticized as much, well, not as mean-spirited as Joe McCarthy and Ernst Zindel, but you have been severely criticized openly for your expose of the Federal Reserve.
Well, I haven't been attacked directly for that. You see, when my book was published in 1953, it was immediately attacked by the Anti-Defamation League of Dene Brith as a virulently anti-Semitic book. And they still maintain that to the present day. And they call me a rabid anti-Semite. When the fact is, when I went to live in New York, I was entirely supported by Jewish people. And I lived with Benjamin Friedman and Henry Klein and people like that. And the first the first defenders of our Federal Reserve book were people like a Hollywood screenwriter, Myron Fagan, who was the first champion of the Federal Reserve book that I had written.
He passed.
He campaigned for it for years.
Yeah, he passed away recently, didn't he?
He was a terrific guy. I did get to know him in my last years in New York, or his last years. And he was in there at the very time. He was being persecuted a lot. He was being beaten up and robbed in his rooms at in New York City. And he's going through the sort of thing I'm still going through right now.
And he was, wasn't he accused of being part of that the Communist Screenwriters Guild or something of that nature?
No, he was very anti-communist, and the Screenwriters Guild began to fight him openly. They tried to get rid of him. No, he was not part of the Screenwriters Guild. You may be thinking of the great Ronald Reagan of the Screen Actors Guild, who is known as Red Ronnie in some parts of Hollywood.
Well, he did have. He had, well, look, we all go through changes in our lives from one philosophy to another.
Oh, certainly.
His
apex came when he from California, when he brought the Hoover Institute people, who were all Trotsky communists, in as his administration when he was elected president in 1980. And that's when the neocons began to take over the country.
Yeah. Now, in the other two books, and you've written many books, you wrote a book, The Writ for Martyrs and My Life in Christ.
Oh, yes.
Where you detail how you've been harassed by various government agencies during...
Oh, that's still going on 24 hours a day.
It is?
I'm being besieged by letters from the Internal Revenue Service because I recently circulated a letter in which I stated that the IRS, Department of the Treasury, was stripped of its powers in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, and the Federal Reserve System was officially named the Fiscal Agent of the United States. But the IRS and Department of the Treasury are still collecting income tax from Americans in their own right, and they have no authority whatsoever.
Are you saying the Internal Revenue Service is not a government agency?
It's a government agency, Department of the Treasury, but the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, signed by Woodrow Wilson and enacted into law by Congress, stripped the Department of the Treasury of its office as fiscal agent of the United States government. And it's really had nothing to do since 1913, except through the IRS that uses the IRS as a tax collection agency. But they're collecting income taxes from American workers for the Federal Reserve System to pay the interest on the money that we borrow from the Federal Reserve System.
Well, you do know we're only about just a little over a month away from the big day, so I'm not shocked or amazed to hear that.
Well, April 15th is a big day for most Americans. It's a day of fear and trembling, and a lot of guys have gone to prison. I've known a lot of people, so-called tax protesters, who did very stiff prison terms under very harsh conditions. They were sent to Springfield, Illinois, the toughest prison in the federal system. And they came out of there broken men simply because they objected to the collection of the income tax as presently is being performed. So it's a very sensitive area.
Well, as I said, especially at this time of the year, and I also find it interesting, and I don't know whether this is an old conspiracy theory, but if you look at a calendar, April the 15th is the furthest day away from the first Tuesday in November. I wonder if that's a coincidence.
That's quite interesting, yes. No, I never thought of that, but it is quite a coincidence, and you have to wonder if these people know what they're doing. They seem to be pretty good on things like that.
Yes, yes. Well, it's amazing. Over the next month, I'm sure we'll be inundated with stories about people who misreported by a penny on stating their income and have been severely punished for it. So.
Oh, yes. No question about it, because it's lèse majesté. Lèse majesté, because you're insulting the power of authority when you do that.
Yeah, well, it would be nice to think that someone within the Office of Management and Budget were as careful with the pennies as we are supposed to be.
Well, this is supposedly a faith-based presidency, but I wonder if President George Bush ever thinks about the coincidence of April 15th and Easter.
Well, I never question a man's religious beliefs, just simply as a matter of courtesy. So when we had a discussion last time, I was amazed by your answer to one of my questions. Just because for a man who knows so much about the fiat currency of the Federal Reserve System, because I asked you if you owned any gold, and you told me you did not.
Oh, I do not, because I live for the day only. And I'm not educating a family or anything like that. And so I don't think that much about it. Amassing of wealth, you know, my mentor, Ezra Pound, was quite against money. I don't think he ever earned any money in his life. He married a fairly well-to-do girl. And she was of the Shakespeare family of England, and she had a nice income, and they lived on that all the years of his marriage.
What is your feeling about gold?
Well, I think gold is very good. It's still considered quite valuable. I don't have any, and I never really expected. Now, I do remember that when Ezra was imprisoned as a traitor, but not convicted, at San Luis Hospital in Washington, that he began to have a lot of money coming in from the sale of his books in Europe after World War II. And he told me he was investing most of the money in gold.
My guest is Eustace Mullins. Final segment coming up. We'll put a bow on this hour. Be right back. This hour is Eustace Mullins, and Ms. Mullins, you have a website where folks can get hold of your books and.
Yes, I do. My website is doing quite well, and I have a lot of articles on it too. It's www.eustacemullins.com.
And. With a few minutes left here, we got Bob in Kansas. Hey, Bob.
I'm glad to. Hello.
Yeah,
hello.
You're up, Bob.
Yeah, I was gonna. I'm glad to hear Eustace on. I want to know, for starters, Eustace, on your website, is there anything that do you offer any of the old broadcasts or transcripts of the broadcast of Ezra Pound, your mentor?
Oh heavens, no! I have a very small website. It lists my current books and what's available, but I don't have room for anything like that.
Do you have any idea how that could be procured or any way I could find it?
Oh, there have been two editions of Ezra Pound's broadcast published in the 1950s. I think they're both out of print, but they're quite good. And, in fact, they give the lie to everything that he was ever accused of, because he was alerting the United States to the importance of our Constitution. And the Germans were very suspicious of him because they thought he was broadcasting in code. They couldn't figure out what he was up to.
Yeah, well, the truth always perplexes people like that.
Well, it certainly does.
You know, I'm going to have to research him because he's very interesting, and I'm going to have people go to your website. But one other thing I wanted to say, you guys, you have no reason to complain about the communists whatsoever, because if it weren't for them, you'd have never written your books in the first place. And wasn't Trotsky's real name Leon Braunstein?
Braunstein, yes.
And wasn't Marx's name Levy?
Who?
Levy. Wasn't his real last name Levy?
Oh, yes.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's pretty well, even though Jewish people took good care of you, how come every time we flip a rock over on one of these communist conspiracy deals, how come they always seem to turn up to be people like that, huh?
Well, Maron Fagan went through a lot of tough times in Hollywood after he came out for advertising my book, because they really went after him on that.
Do you carry any Maron Fagan's tape?
No, I don't have anything of Maron Fagan. I don't have anything to remember him by. You see, he was in Hollywood, and I was in Washington. We were far apart. We finally met about 25 years later in New York City. But we just never got together.
I would like to have a permanent recording of that. Brought the tapes he made. I'm sure you've heard them.
Oh, I think those tapes are available. People tell me that they're available. I think maybe Jim Warner in New Orleans. I'm going to be speaking in New Orleans in a little while. I'll find out where the Maron Fagan tapes are.
Well, someday, if people wise up, you may be viewed as a national treasure, but I view you as one myself now. Thank you.
You're welcome indeed.
Thanks, Bob. The website, EustaceMullins.com, spelled EustaceMullins.com, all lower casings. And you can order the book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve. Eustace, thank you so much, sir.
Delightful to be on your program.
Absolutely. We'll do it again, sir.
Well, very good.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Stay tuned, my friends. Another hour still to come on this Tuesday.